Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. As we enter the final days of the year, it's come to the time to reflect on all that 2023 was. You can find me under the
lights, diamonds under my eyes. This is the best day ever.
It is the best day ever. So is yesterday, and so is tomorrow, and every day from now until forever. Yes! You guys ever think about dying?
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
The cultural sphere was dominated by the filmic double bill of the summer, and we were blessed with an elegant new portmanteau, Barbenheimer. It took over cinemas, the group chat, and seemed to save the summer box office by providing a ready-made back-to-the-cinema experience of wild extremes.
Please do not be alarmed, remain calm. Do not attempt to leave the dance floor. The DJ booth is conducting a troubleshoot test of the entire system.
The global tours of two of the world's biggest singers brought fans out in droves to sing and shimmy along to the sounds of Beyoncé and Taylor Swift. And in the perhaps quieter realm of the publishing world, it was yet another win for the blue-bound indie darling Fitzcarraldo Editions as they scooped yet another Nobel Prize for Literature with this year's win by John Fosser. But what about in our very own corner of the cultural radio sphere we've carved out here at Monocle Radio? Well, we've interviewed authors and artists, pop stars and poets, and a fair few in between. And today we present some snapshots of our favourite conversations. What better place to start than with a particularly buoyant conversation we enjoyed with the writers behind the film Rye Lane. The movie follows protagonists Yaz and Dom as they spend the day getting to know each other while they roam the streets of southeast London. It's both a romantic comedy and a Technicolor love letter to Peckham. And I loved hearing more about its creation from writers Nathan Byron and Tom Mellier. Here's Nathan.
For me, when we're making this movie, we're not trying to enlighten conversations about gentrification. This is a love story. Yeah. This is about joy. This is Rain painting the most beautiful, magical depiction of Peckham, where she grew up, you know, where she's from. If people want to have those conversations alongside what we're doing, great, bring it on, you know. Everyone's going to watch it and have a different take on it. And yeah. I think that's kind of the importance of, you know, the film, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's kind of feels like
thought
a dirt.
It wasn't then, didn't you? I thought he was going to.
Yeah,
not
Nathan,
agree.
I disagree.
He's gone on this.
I've got a think piece coming out this weekend, actually.
Yeah.
You've done too many think pieces about me.
But no, it's sort of a dirty word, but our main thing going into this was we wanted to entertain people. Mm. And there are plenty of films that we love that are kind of a bit more po-faced and a bit more serious and talking about very important issues, and they obviously have their place as well, but we wanted to write a party film. Mm. We wanted to write one of those films that was so important to us when we were 16, 17, yeah. 18 years old, that you would put on when you were feeling sad to cheer you up, or you'd put on before you were going on a night out to get you into the mood, or when you came back from the pub because you couldn't be bothered to watch something you didn't know. And just one of those kind of warm hugs where...
I love that idea.
Where you know the lines and you love the characters like they're your mates. That's what we set out to do. And we set it in a place that we know really well and a place that we... near where we both were born and grew up. And of course, I understand why certain conversations have started, but we couldn't avoid setting it somewhere that we know incredibly well, just in case there was going to be those conversations. So it is what it is, I think.
Yeah, and also, like, you know, one of my favourite moments from this process so far was premiere night, where we were in Peckhamplex, and we're watching it with loads of the community from Peckham, and there's a massive pink carpet in Peckham and a big billboard, and you can see the community are watching the film and knowing this is their home. Like, and I felt really proud of that. I actually got emotional. I got emotional because I was like, oh man, like, I feel like this is what we really wanted to do. And obviously everyone's unique opinion matters and counts, but I feel proud that we set out to achieve hopefully what we
Yeah, you haven't made, you haven't tried to make a documentary about plight.
No,
you've made a
no.
you've made a romantic comedy set in a particular area of the of London.
And celebrating the people in that area. And you can't go, well, we shouldn't celebrate an area that we love and the people who live there just in case X happens. Yeah. What a strange way to live.
Rye Lane writers Tom Mellier and Nathan Bryon there. And that film would really make for some cosy Christmas watching if you haven't yet seen it. Next, we mark the release of the disco-tinged, effervescent pop album That Feels Good with its sparkly creator, Jessie Ware. Jessie, join me in the studio for a lively chat. And we started, of course, by getting our compliments on each other's glowiness out of the way first.
Why have you got a tan? Where have you been?
Scotland.
No, stop. I had to pay for Cyprus for this miniature glow.
Oh, you look wonderful.
Well, no.
It's going
I mean,
well.
You know, yours looks a bit better. Where were you
You've
in Scotland?
You've got promo, like Edinburgh.
Oh, I love Edinburgh.
honestly, I think it might be Windburn, Jessie. That's what it is.
Up older Arthur's seat.
Exactly.
Fine.
Yeah, leave Arthur's seat out of it. Talking of which, I feel your record, That Feels Good, is kind of aimed at, it's grabbing people by a certain body part with some of the titles, some of the song titles such as Shake the Bottle, Freak Me Now.
Genitalia.
Short and Curlies. I was going to say Scruff of the Neck. We could go further
short
down.
I don't know what kind of Short and Curlies you're talking about, Rob. I just made this so lowbrow for Monica. I'm so sorry.
We're about
to go there. Let's go there.
We've sort of started. I know, sorry. I think it was we got overexcited.
Yeah.
It's the lack of breakfast and the coffee.
Oh, yeah. We could go anywhere now.
That's kind of, yeah. So how soon into recording the record did you choose such a vibey, grabbing people by the scruff of the neck title?
Well, as soon as we made That Feels Good, I knew I wanted it to be the album title. Yeah. It felt so kind of buoyant and fun, and also the song was fun, and so I wanted it to start the record. But I also thought it's quite a funny old title because it's got the exclamations, the double exclamation, which somebody on the internet, when I announced it, said that the only other person they think that they can remember that's got that is Shania Twain with Man, I Feel Like a Woman.
Oh, that's good.
And that
knowledge.
Went quite well for them. So yeah. I feel like hopefully the only way is up.
There you
this
go,
record.
Reeling in the Grammys.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you'd probably put an extension on.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be great.
just to hold them. So that. You call it That Feels Good.
Well, I loved.
You can't keep stopping in the middle of the
sentence. I appreciated how you did a pause. I did appreciate that. I just think if I do that every time, people are going to think I'm an absolute wanker. Are you not? You're not allowed. Are we live?
You are allowed.
Are we live?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
We're not live, but we're also not the BBC.
Okay. Okay, great.
So you're okay.
Okay, great.
Wankers are fine.
Perfect.
Welcome. Always welcome. And this is such a buoyant, bouncy. It's such a vibey record.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful. It's been used for some pre-release soundtrack dance parties in SE3.
Okay, good.
And is it as fun to make a record that sounds that fun, or is it a work of teeth grinding lunacy until it comes out and you're like, this is wonderful. It sounds like this.
It is fun, but there was a lot of kind of frustration making this record because we were still part of a lockdown when I started making it. So we were making a lot of it over the internet on Zoom, which I don't advise to anybody to do ever. Yeah. I never want to go back there. However, maybe that's what made things like Begin Again and That Feels Good happen, because there was this need for escapism. It was so fun working with James Ford again, Shin Goodzo, Danny.
Yeah.
And also meeting Stuart Price, who I hadn't worked with before, who's done records like Confessions on the Dance Floor. It was fun.
Pet Shop Boys, song called Madonna, yes. I believe.
Yes. Yeah.
Decent pedigree.
Yeah, not bad.
That was the singer Jessie Ware discussing her latest album, That Feels Good.
Now to some very different musicians. Over the past two decades, the Mexican duo Rodrigo y Gabriela have strummed their way from buskers to superstars. Created under lockdown and new management, their 2023 album In Between Thoughts, A New World, took their instrumental sound in a new electronic direction. On the UK leg of their global tour earlier this year, they stopped by Midori House.
Man, we feel like we are 20, you know, it's like they are so excited. We got the best record deal from, you know, yeah. our careers. We, you know, it's like
it's amazing. Yeah. I should say, I should let our listeners in, shine some light in upon the magic of the studio experience here. Rodrigo and Gabriela are very good looking people, very well preserved. Presumably all that fretwork, all that strumming, all those strings are very good. They're good for the body, I presume. But what else is going on? Because, Rodrigo, you're also wearing a sort of flight suit, an all-in-one flight suit. I feel like you might have just walked in out of, as an extra in Top Gun Maverick.
No.
I feel like we should also be saluting you. Is this part of the onstage?
It's part of the onstage.
Is this what you're going to be wearing on stage at the Roundhouse?
For sure, yeah. I don't wear special things, but, yeah, I feel... I think it's part of it. I think this new album brought, because of the concept that we will probably talk about, it brought like a new light, you know, into the whole perspective of our lives, you know.
Rodrigo from the duo Rodrigo y Gabriela there discussing their 2023 record, In Between Thoughts, A New World. Now, as I mentioned in today's introduction, the summer and, well, most of the year was dominated filmically by Barbenheimer. I was lucky enough to speak with the filmmaker at the helm of one half of that phenomenon, Christopher Nolan. As his film is undoubtedly an intimate portrait of its protagonist, J. Robert Oppenheimer, I asked Christopher Nolan if he viewed Oppenheimer as an unwilling competitor in the arms race.
I think unwilling... Sometimes. Is up for debate. I think it's ambiguous. I think that the man had tremendous ambition, and he had a tremendous sense of his own theatricality, his own drama, and how to use that. And I think those things come into play in his decision making in ways that are a little frightening when thought of in the context of you know, the global well being, if you want to say, and the ways in which he changed the world. But that's what's wonderfully evolving to me about his story. Reading the book, you know, I get to the moment where I realize that Los Alamos, this place that lives in infamy, really, I mean, it's today still one of the key sites of the development of present-day nuclear weapons. That was a place he liked to go camping with his brother. And, you know, you first hear the name and you're like, it's that personal. And he says, you know, if I could find a way to combine physics in New Mexico, my life would be complete. And you think, okay, this desire, this idiosyncratic, you know, simple human feeling about things is going to change the world forever.
Yeah. Yes, it does feel like that. It feels like if it happened in a British context, the New Forest would never be the same or something like this, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Beware.
Exactly. Yeah, Cheltenham.
Where you spend your summer holidays, exactly. And in that human sense, there's a sort of, it's quite a chamber piece. A lot of it happens in rooms and cocktail parties, in lecture theatres and in classrooms and things, as much as that broad new town, which kind of Los Alamos becomes, I suppose.
Yeah.
What was, and obviously set against the vastness of the ambition of the project and what it laid waste to, I suppose. You're quite sparing with the pyrotechnics in this movie. And I wondered how early that was written into your plan for the film to, it's not a crash, bang, wallop situation that we find ourselves in, despite the largeness of it.
Yeah. Well, scale and you know, we talked about momentum, but scale in cinema is a hard thing to pin down. It's not just about the literal scale of the set you build or the world you're trying to create. It's often about the humanity involved and we knew we needed, and we got, you know, the huge vistas of New Mexico in contrast with the people, you know, the thunderous nature of the weather there and everything that prefigures and so forth. But ultimately, a lot of the scale comes from the group of people who are assembled, the disparate points of view that come together, the community of scientists, the military community, how they interact. And, you know, very early on, it was apparent to me that having got Killian to play the lead, I now needed to people this world with a lot of extraordinary actors. Mm. You know, and we have Matt Damon and Robert Downey Jr., Emily Blunt, Florence Pugh, many others, but also a lot of fresher faces, young actors coming together to portray, you know, it's Richard Feynman or Robert Serber, you know, these guys coming together to get across a couple of interesting facts about this story. The average age of everyone in Los Alamos is about 28. The number of Americans involved in making the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is about 600,000. So this was the ultimate sort of group effort.
That was the filmmaker Christopher Nolan there discussing his big movie, Oppenheimer. Now, over the years, the two-time Pulitzer-winning writer Colson Whitehead has turned his hand to non-fiction, zombie thrillers and historical fiction. His new book, Crook Manifesto, is the second in his Harlem trilogy, which is set on the chaotic streets of 1970s New York. I sat down with Colson to discuss this exciting new heist novel. But before we get into our conversation, here he is reading a passage. In this excerpt, Carney traverses the city he calls home and reflects on where he's come from and his now comfortable life on the aptly named Stryver's Row.
Carney caught the one train at 125th Street and grabbed a seat on the east side of the car. The Manhattan Viaduct lifted the train tracks 168 feet above Broadway and 125th, and if you didn't have your nose in a book or the daily paper or a tattered ledger of regrets, the view was a pleasant reprieve from the gloomy tunnel. It held no charm for Carney. If he sat on the opposite side, he was liable to see his old place, catty corner to the tracks, which for many years had made him a captive audience to the Viaduct's longest-running show. It was the same performance, repeated without variation, the curtain rising multiple times an hour, relentlessly exploring through choreography and noise a single theme of the human condition: you can't afford a better apartment.
Colson, thank you so much for your time today, and congratulations on a beautiful second helping of this trilogy. There's so many things to pick up on in Crook Manifesto, this second novel in this series. But the first thing that I'd like to ask you about is Harlem and New York itself. It's such a busy, vibrant, unputdownable character in the book. And I wanted to ask you first about your research process for it, your own memories of the city and how they kind of came together, the fact and the fiction, you walking the streets and looking at things on Google Maps, no doubt, and how they came together to form the soul of the book, I guess.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I was a very young child in the early 70s, so don't have many memories of this period, so that does mean a lot of research. What I do recall was that the city was dirty, people were tense, you know, crime was at an all-time high. That doesn't get you very far in the book. I've been on this run of doing what people call historical novels. For me, they're just novels set in the past, but people like that term, so I'll go with it. And usually, you know, primary sources are a great resource. In Underground Railroad, it was slave narratives. In the Nickel Boys, it was survivor accounts from the Dozier Academy, the model for the Nickel Academy. And this book, it's been newspapers, whether I'm trying to figure out what's happening in New York City politically that I can use for the book. Sometimes it's a bigger event. In Crook Manifesto, the opening section takes place in 1971, and there's a big historic police corruption investigation called the Knapp Commission underway. And that allows me to bring in my corrupt detective Munson into the story. As you said, there's a lot of walking around. You know, I lived there when I was a little kid, but never hung around Harlem that much. So it's as alien to me, you know, as Georgia in the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
So I would just walk around, location scouting, trying to figure out where would be a good block on 125th for Carney to work, a good place for him to grow up, across from the subway tracks. And if it's across from the subway tracks, is it better to be 127th Street or 135th Street, and what can you see from those windows? So all that kind of stuff.
That was Colson Whitehead reading from his book, Crook Manifesto. And now to another writer. As well as being a novelist, Tessa Hadley is loved and lauded as a master of the short story form. So I was delighted to have Tessa into the studio to discuss her latest collection, After the Funeral, in which the stories are piercing, highly controlled and incredibly tender. Over to Tessa Hadley.
I sometimes think when I ask myself why it took me a long, long time to get it right with writing. I was really writing a long time before I wrote anything that felt true. Hmm. And I think I was part of the answer is I was just soaking stuff up, like everybody does. It's like everybody does. Hmm. We all watch each other, some more, some less. We soak that stuff in and we identify it and we're curious about it and we fantasize what lies behind what we see. So I suppose that's why that recurs in my stories, people watching other people. It's paradigmatic in human relations, isn't it?
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're just locked inside ourselves, bumping up into people like automatons, whereas actually we are greedily curious about others. In real life, often wrong. We often read the wrong thing. We're not always all that good at reading each other, though crucially, we're good enough. And it binds us all together. But in fiction, one's allowed to be right. You're allowed to watch people and actually know what they're doing and what they're thinking.
Yeah. No, because they're really affecting and effective moments in your prose and in the story, I suppose. And I just wanted to ask you how those things worked. And you sort of said, and I know that you came to being published in your 40s. Mm-hmm. That's a fact well known for all the people that love your work, Tessa. Were you a noticer of things up until that point? Or did you finally become an inventor? Or was it the same process? Something just clicked, I wonder.
I mean, I suspect that noticing things one has as a continuum with many other people. As I say, not everybody, but there's a huge, important, maybe half of people are soaking each other up all the time. And then there's this other funny, weird thing that writers do, which is, like, painters learn, which is very odd and against nature, to make pictures of what they're soaking up and seeing. And it's just as unnatural to make stories out of it. People think sometimes, I think, because writing is done in language, that it's more natural, there's a more straightforward line from just seeing and observing and being interested in and being fascinated by to putting it into a story. But actually, it's as artificial as then sitting down to make a picture of it. And that's the painful, long learning process, doing justice to what one has. And where does one have it? It's not exactly in front of your eyes, of course. Analogy with painting breaks down, you know, because I didn't see any of that stuff happening. But somewhere you've watched, you've taken that inside imagination and inside fantasy, and then you play the scene in your mind's eye, but with a scrupulous realism, drawing on observation. And then you have to painfully and with great difficulty find the true sentences that do justice to what's in your mind's eye.
That was the writer Tessa Hadley there with her fascinating insight on the writing process. Next, we made a very special show about the photographer Hiroshi Sugimoto in light of his survey exhibition at London's Hayward Gallery. The show is bountiful. The photos include dioramas that breathe new life into taxidermied animals, haunting images of cinemas and drive-ins, and portraits of Madame Tussaud's waxworks that resurrect figures such as Napoleon and Princess Diana. Sugimoto's seascapes are particularly stunning. They're shot from a fixed point with a long exposure and contain sea and sky and nothing else. Here's the artist himself discussing those seascapes.
Well, I've been photographing seascapes over like 3 decades, but now I start seeing something changing. I cannot see anymore the kind of primordial kind of scene of seascapes. Even I go back to the same spot, there's a leisure boat and hotels, and so I cannot find any more untouched, almost untouched nature as a sea. So, well, only one chance now I have is I established my own foundation facing the Pacific Ocean. And there's so many fishing boats around every day. Only one day, January 1st, nobody's out.
That's your opportunity.
So I have once every year, one day, able to photograph the seascapes of without human activities.
beautiful. And just finally, we know that your practice extends to architecture and the built environment as well. You've touched on the relationship with your work and the Hayward Gallery here, but how do you judge the coming together of your work and the architecture of this very well-known building, at least in London?
Well, this is a quite unique design, as you know. It's not fancy at all, intentionally, and no decoration. So this is the best for my show, the space itself, and beautiful natural light, and then pitch dark room with my special lighting. And so, well, this is the best show I can imagine. And space-wise, I'm very happy. And this is my first time to see myself, my survey, my career, what I've been doing. And, well, I'm convinced myself. I'm pleased myself, my life.
So it's something a bit like turning the camera on yourself. It's a bit of a self-portrait we're looking at.
Huh? Self-portrait?
Perhaps this show.
Yeah, this is my self-portrait. Yes. This is retrospective, probably. So, well, I'm very happy myself, so that I'm ready to die.
A touching end to that interview with the great Hiroshi Sugimoto. And a reminder that there are still a couple of weeks left to catch Sugimoto and those wonderful seascapes at the Hayward Gallery if you're in London. A definitive highlight of the year was our dispatch from Turin, where we covered the city's contemporary art fair and the Sea-to-Sea Music Festival. And I particularly loved meeting the classically trained pianist turned experimental musician Marina Herlop backstage ahead of her Sea-to-Sea set. Here's Marina discussing her pre-performance rituals.
More than ritual, I think that I try to achieve a mindset that is in a sweet spot between being like emotional and open to what's going on, as in you cannot be super cold or a robot or too technical. You need to be open to emotions, but also not too much, because then the technique of what you do can get a bit twisted, or, you know, can be worse if you're too emotional. You know, so I see it as the mood that a fighter can have in a fight, you know, like really focused and really like alert of your surrounding and what's going on and observing everything, but also like cold enough to, you know, to think with your mind. If you're too emotional, if you're too not emotional and too cold, then the quality of the gig is not perfect.
And you mentioned emotion, and that is something that your music has, well, has so many different influences and so many different sounds, textures. It's so rich and layered. But the emotional side of it seems to me, catches me every time I hear it. Is that something that you look down sometimes at the audience and you kind of catch them having a moment with you? You lock eyes with people. It's a tough thing when you're in a big theatre, a big dark theatre like this. But is that something that you've seen in the past that you seek out when you perform in front of people?
It's sort of started to happening right now, like in the last 2 years, that I've got to realize that listeners and people that come to the shows really can get moved and emotional with the music. And so I try to look at them as much as possible, because I want to grasp what's going on, and I feel very lucky, you know, and grateful for everything. So I try to catch those memories and keep them with me, and I try to make eye contact and have live the experience with them. But at the same time, sometimes that makes me feel too emotional and want to cry. So I cannot get too emotional. Yeah. Because then, so for example, sometimes if my mom comes to the show or my dad and I see them, then I cannot look at them, because then I want to cry.
That was the musician Marina Herlop backstage at Turin's Sea to Sea Festival. And that is all for this week and for this year. We hope you've enjoyed coming along for the ride, and we can't wait to be back in the saddle in the new year. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the programme. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you for tuning in.